This is John Howell Essential Cuts, your daily rundown of the best of the best from today's show on 890 WLS.
423 here. That's Tyler Bravo picking out the music as our technical director. Our executive producer is Brett Gogol. Steven Trafficante, I'm surprised he has not demanded a video from me today. He's our associate producer, and he handles the socials. And Kim Gordon has another update coming up here at the bottom of the hour from the award-winning WDLS Newsroom. So finally, late on Friday night, they managed to pass infrastructure bill, the little bitty one. It's all right to be little bitty, Alan Jackson used to say. The small one, the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. They finally got that done late on Friday. I'm not exactly sure what was in the negotiations to have the progressives of the Democratic Party, who are ridiculously fighting amongst themselves and going to cause a huge smash-up on turn number one in November of 2022. Hey, if you can't handle your party, you can't handle the country. My policy. So part number two is in jeopardy, as it should be. It's loaded with a bunch of nonsense. The $1.75 trillion plan. But even the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, as Pete Buttigieg said, he said it's the biggest federal expenditure in this category since Eisenhower.
This is the largest investment in roads, bridges, and highways since the creation of the interstate highway system.
Let's welcome Faith Abube, ABC News correspondent, watching this in D.C. this afternoon as the gears continue to turn. Faith, knowing what we know about the $1.2 trillion and how long it took to get that done, is it safe to say that part number two, the $1.75 trillion, Manchin's dug in on that, Sinema's dug in on that, that's DOA at this point?
No, not according to Democrats. They still plan to move forward with that. We could see movement on that as soon as next week. Congress returns to session on November 15th. Both the House and Senate will be back, and so they'll be able to work on that. What's been holding Democrats up is the fact that some moderates have asked for a Congressional Budget Office rating, a score on how that package, that soft infrastructure package called the Build Back Better Plan, how that will affect the federal budget. And so they're waiting on that. They expect to have that the week of November 15th, which is next week. And then if the numbers add up to the way the moderates think it needs to, and everything is paid for, as the president has been saying and a lot of Democrats have been saying, then they plan to support it. Progressives are behind the package already. And so it's just a matter of waiting for that score to come back to support the argument that the president has been making for that to move forward. But they're, for now, already back in their home states, celebrating this bipartisan infrastructure bill that was able to get through both the House and the Senate after a long, arduous process. You know, that one took 87 days, two visits by the president to the Capitol, dozens of meetings between lawmakers and the White House over the phone for hours and hours in order to get this passed. So Democrats are pumped that they were able to give President Biden this legislative win on his agenda, and now they have one more to go.
Faith Abube is here from ABC News. She's in D.C. Give us some of the high points, for lack of a better descriptor. What exactly is in this $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill? Just break it down by handfuls of billions, if you would.
Yeah, so you're talking $110 billion, for example, for highways and bridges and roads. So some of these will be building new highways. Some of these will be to upgrade the highways that are crumbling across the country, bridges, roads, things like that. $65 billion will go to upgrading our power grid. $39 billion has been set aside for public transit. So think Amtrak, for example, or buses, or, you know, just any kind of public transit you can think of. There'll be money going towards things like that to improve the system, upgrade the system, bring it into the 21st century. You have $65 billion, for example, to expand Internet access. There are a lot of communities across the country that don't have broadband access. They're unable to get on the Internet. And so this bill will be able to help expand that. $55 billion has been set aside for clean water. I know that has been an issue a lot of communities have been grappling with. Oh, you saw recently there was discussion in Michigan, for example, about, you know, lead in the water. And so, you know, that $55 billion, according to the president, will go towards helping communities get access to clean water. So this is a massive, massive undertaking. The single largest investment in the nation's traditional infrastructure that we've seen in decades. And so the task right now is for the White House and those who actually voted for it, both Democrats and Republicans, to head out there and explain to the American people what's actually in it. You know, what's funny is a recent ABC News poll suggests that roughly 70% of Americans at this time don't know a lot about this package or have no idea what's actually in the bill and how it'll help the economy. So they do have a lot of work to do to explain this to the American people. As soon as Wednesday, we are expecting the president to head over to the Port of Baltimore to discuss how this package will help upgrade the nation's ports and strengthen the supply chains. For example, this is an issue that, you know, affecting a lot of Americans right now. As you know, the supply chain issues have caused gas prices and oil prices to go up. And we're, according to the energy secretary, we're expecting heating your homes to warm up this winter to actually cost you more than it did last year because of this supply chain problem. So the hope here is that money from this infrastructure bill, money from for the projects will actually help prevent future disruptions like we're currently witnessing here. And so they're going to be selling it, both Democrats and Republicans who voted for this, for the next few weeks and months and maybe even years to come.
And there were 13 Republicans who voted for this in the House. And I know that the far right of the Republican Party is calling for them to have their heads lopped off for voting for this.
The Republicans are facing a lot of backlash for basically handing President Biden a legislative win, right? You know, the president was on the campaign trail, you know, fighting for this and campaigning on this, and then made this a core project, a core priority for his agenda here in Washington. And then finally, you know, he gets it passed through and he's celebrating. And a lot of Republicans who are watching this play out believe that, you know, their counterparts were able to hand this win to the president. As you said, 13 Republicans, Democrats in the House to get this across the finish line, 19 in the Senate were able to do that. You have GOP leader Mitch McConnell, who was part of the 19 that voted for this, already today in his home state in Kentucky, selling details of this package, touting it as, you know, something that's great. He says he's delighted that it was passed. At the end of the day, despite all the backlash that some of these Republicans are getting, they believe that this is something that the nation needed and that they did the right thing. Now, as for the Build Back Better plan, that is another issue. They don't want any part of it. They think that it's something that is a more of a progressive left-wing agenda, and yeah, they don't want any part of it. They want Democrats to do it alone.
I've learned that both red and blue love green. Faith Abube, thank you so much for your time this afternoon and bringing us update on this. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
I was delighted that the House finally found a way to pass the infrastructure bill last week.
Build back better,
build back a better future.
We're going to build back better our democracy and restore humanity.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Over the weekend, I saw a column by our next guest and thought we should probably talk to him on Monday afternoon now that they've set a date. Understand it's going to be three different cases consolidated. And it's the week of December 6th, and a three-judge federal court panel will finally work all this nonsense out. Or maybe I'm just way too optimistic. Peter Hancock is a State House reporter for Capitol Hill News, Illinois. And Peter, welcome back. Thanks so much for your time, sir. Much appreciated.
Good to be here, John.
Do you feel as if you're more likely to have an accident or a heart attack because of the time change over the weekend?
You know, it always does rattle me. I think they should just pick one or the other and just stick with it.
That's a hill I'm prepared to die on. I'm not kidding you. I'd prefer to have the extra light at the end of the day, selfishly, for my own purposes, frankly, but just pick one and leave it.
Yeah.
There's no chance of that happening now. So, yeah. December 6th, this three-judge federal panel, and all three suits are going to be heard at the same time. That seems to be counterproductive.
Well, they all deal with the same issues, essentially. And they're on a pretty tight time frame because candidates have to start gathering nominating petitions in January. But to do that, you got to know what district you live in. So they're trying to get this all settled at once. It's not that uncommon in federal courts to see several related cases kind of merge together.
Yeah, and I should have been clear in my intro, but we're talking about the legislative district maps, state maps, not the congressional maps at this time. So we have three lawsuits. We have the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, MALDEF, and we also have the Republicans. Where's the third one come from? Pardon my ignorance.
The NAACP branch of East St. Louis. They are focused on the Metro East region and some things that happened down there.
How do the Republicans feel about being thrown into the same process as the other two advocacy groups?
Well, I don't think they're complaining about it. I think they have their own arguments, but in many ways they're very similar to the arguments that MALDEF and the NAACP are making. That basically, the Democrats, there are two words that they use in redistricting, packing and cracking. That is, you can pack minority groups into one district or a small number of districts in order to limit their representation. Or you can crack up their neighborhoods and split them into several districts to limit their representation. And all of the plaintiffs are alleging that the Democrats engaged in both, mainly with Hispanic voters in the Chicago area and with black voters in the East St. Louis area.
And all three plaintiffs, including the Republicans, are leaning on the Voting Rights Act of 65?
Right, that and the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause, and that's where you get the one man, one vote, or one person, one vote doctrine.
How do they decide who argues first, second, third? How's it set up? When, is, you know, how's that going to work with the federal judges?
Draws. I don't know. We're just kind of waiting for this hearing to come around. They actually haven't even decided whether they're going to call this a trial or an evidentiary hearing or a battle of the expert witnesses or, you know, what. I don't know. You know, I imagine there are going to be four tables in front of the bench, one for the state and one for each of the sets of plaintiffs.
So the plaintiffs have to have their paperwork in by Wednesday, and then the Democrats have until Monday the 22nd for the response, and then the week of December 6th, it gets sorted out.
That's the schedule they've laid out so far.
All 177 House and Senate districts are up for grabs?
Yeah, but the plaintiffs actually aren't arguing all 177 districts. They're arguing a handful of districts in the Chicago area and a handful of districts in the St. Louis area. Mainly they're focusing on Southwest Chicago and the Southwest suburbs, which are largely Latino neighborhoods. And then East St. Louis, which is largely African American.
Yeah. Home of Miles Davis, by the way.
Yes.
What is the political, I know it's not supposed to matter, so just pardon me for asking. The three federal judges, do we know the political mix on those three judges by chance?
I think it's pretty mixed. I looked it up at one point. I can't recall it off the top of my head. It's fairly mixed. One of them, I believe, has taken what's called senior status. They're kind of semi-retired. But there's one judge from Illinois, one from Indiana, and one from Wisconsin who serves on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals.
And where does this debate take place? Up here or downstate? Dirksen Federal Building?
That's what they're planning on right now. They haven't totally decided whether it's going to be in person or remote. There are a lot of logistical issues to take care of. But they're leaning toward an in-person hearing at the Dirksen Building there on the Loop.
Interesting mix of plaintiffs. Politics makes strange bedfellows, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does in a way. I mean, you don't often see the Republican Party lined up with the NAACP and a Latino advocacy group, except to the extent that I think the Illinois Republican Party is really trying to engage in some outreach to the Latino community and the African-American community, trying to expand their base a little bit. So in that regard, they're probably not too uncomfortable with it. But I think their main interest is in trying to redraw the district so you have more competitive districts, especially in the St. Louis area. But I think, you know, they also want to show the Latino community that, hey, we care about you too.
Yeah. Politicians always say they want more competitive districts, but they love it when they can grab their own constituents. Peter Hancock, thank you, sir, for your time. We'll read more at Capitol Hill News, Illinois. And excellent analysis as always.
Okay. Well, thanks, John.
Take care.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
I'll bet you a dime to a dollar that our next conversation will be on our Essential Cuts podcast later this evening. We always get great information from our next guest, Jason Nathanson, out in L.A., reporting on entertainment for ABC News. And a big part of entertainment nowadays is, well, litigation. And in the wake of the stampede at the Astroworld Festival in Houston, rapper Travis Scott says he'll personally refund all attendees. He won't be hitting the stage anytime soon, pulling out of concerts this weekend in Vegas. And lawsuits have already been filed. Let's welcome Jason Nathanson to discuss that this afternoon on the Big 89. Anything in addition to what I've laid out as far as any new developments today?
Travis Scott also announced today that he's going to pay for all the funeral costs of those who died during the festival on Friday. So that's in addition, as well as he and the people who put on the concert, they're providing free one-on-one online therapy for anybody who was impacted and is in need of mental health services after that. It seems like, and one of the other performers, Roddy Ricch, also announced that he's donating all the money, all the proceeds from his appearance at the festival to the families of those affected. So it seems like Travis Scott and those around him are trying to do what they can to make this right. But as you mentioned, the lawsuits have been filed. A couple have been filed already, and I'm sure more are going to be coming in the future as everybody tries to investigate exactly what went wrong here, why, what led to this, and could it have been stopped?
Well, anybody that's attended what I call festival seating, which is just everybody grab whatever space you can, we know these things can go bad pretty quickly. But he put out on Instagram, and I have a 10-second clip here, saying, had I known, I would have stopped.
Any time I could make out, you know, anything that's going on, you know, I'd stop the show and, you know, help them get the help they need.
And this is after the chief of police of Houston visited him before the show and said, hey, this crowd seems edgy. You got to keep your eye on this and help us out a little bit. And the fire chief afterwards said, after they had declared a multiple victim incident, that may not be the exact verbiage they used in Houston, but Travis Scott continued to perform for another 30 minutes. Has he addressed that at all?
Not that we know, but it's hard to know what he knew at the time, what he knew from the stage. I've seen videos of people appearing to talk to him on the stage, and then he just keeps going. But we don't know what was said, what he was told, what was communicated to him. And also from the stage, it's, you know, obviously very hard to tell what's going on. You don't know what's a serious incident and what's, you know, just people in the crowd doing whatever people in the crowd do. We've seen over the past couple of days all sorts of videos come forward from various performers who did stop shows in the middle of various things going on because they saw something from the stage that looked suspicious or dangerous to them. Videos from Billie Eilish to Adele, Harry Styles, Linkin Park even. There was one where people were, you know, moshing and things got a little tense and they stopped the performance and said, hey, everybody calm down. And a couple of those videos, the performer said from the stage, look, it's my responsibility to keep you safe. So everybody calm down or we're going to stop the show. Again, we don't know if Travis Scott knew that there were things, dangerous things happening, that people were being hurt at the time or what. I want to believe him. I want to take him at face value and said that if he would have known, he would have stopped. But again, that's what there's going to be an investigation for.
Well, you can always just shut the power off. You know, is this going to be a fight legally, eventually, between Travis Scott and Live Nation, because Live Nation will say he continued to perform. But if I was Travis Scott, I'd say, well, all you have to do is turn off the power and the show stops.
Well, but yeah, I don't know exactly, because I don't know who's involved. You know, Travis Scott is one of the producers of the concert as well. He's one of the people behind it. And so he could obviously have some liability there in addition to being the performer and being the person on the stage, as well as Live Nation being the company that probably has the deepest pockets here. And that, you know, if you are somebody who's going to sue, you're probably just going to name everybody who might be responsible and let the courts figure out at the end of the day who it actually is who's responsible.
Was Live Nation, I'm sorry, I don't mean to sandbag you with this question, was Live Nation the promoter of the Vegas concert massacre?
You know, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Couldn't tell you.
Talking here with Jason Nathanson from ABC News. He's out in Los Angeles. On to the next sort of soon-to-be litigated incident. What is Alec Baldwin now calling and explain why for there to be an armed police officer on every movie set, every scene from this point on? I don't quite understand the logic or how that limits his legal exposure or helps his PR.
He did say that he in a post on social media today that he said, quote, every film/TV set that uses guns, fake or otherwise, should have a police officer on set hired by the production to specifically monitor weapon safety. Again, to your point, though, as to what that would do, not exactly sure, because there are people on sets who actually have maybe even more knowledge of these mm-hmm. guns than a police officer would, in that being the armorer and the prop master. These are people whose jobs it is to use and prepare these guns. These guns, by the way, which should never have live ammunition in them. But on a set like Rust, we're talking old guns, right? There was a Colt 45 that Baldwin had in his hand. And so I am not exactly clear what he thinks, what that would accomplish, because when the protocols are followed, we have seen that Hollywood has been a very safe place when it comes to guns on set. So adding a police officer, not exactly sure what that would do. And he didn't expand on what he thought that would accomplish.
That's a goofy posting, in my opinion. The armorers that I've heard repeatedly since this incident, they don't want any additional weapons on any set. They want to control everything. They would not like that if there was a police officer who was standing over in the corner watching the production, you know, with a 9mm Glock on his hip. They don't want any part of that. And in fact, the gentleman that I've listened to repeatedly through this analysis of this incident, he probably would not take a job if that was part of the set.
I mean, it's a solid point because, again, the issue here and where things went wrong is the fact that there was live ammunition on the set where it shouldn't have been. So if you introduce a police officer with a gun on his hip, then you are putting live ammunition on a set where it should never be, and just increasing the chances that maybe something could go wrong.
Jason, thank you very much for your time, as always, sir. Enjoy the weather on the West Coast, as we are got a couple more days of decent warm weather here and then go into the freezer for a few months.
Well, good luck with it.
I'm not catching any sincerity in your voice there.
I mean, you know, we live here for a reason.
Okay. Thanks. Much appreciated. Take care.
Take care.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts, on 890 WLS.
Oh, there's going to be a lot of legal issues. This Travis Scott has had these type of incidents in the past. One here in town at Lollapalooza a few years ago. I think he was hit with a misdemeanor charge based on that one. He has a history of not stopping concerts in time and also urging the crowd to surge towards the stage. He said on an Instagram post, he posted that had he known, he would have stopped the show.
At any time I could make out, you know, anything that's going on, I'd stop the show and, you know, help them get the help they need.
Live Nation, the promoter's in the soup, too. Eddie's been hanging on since we had this discussion earlier this hour with our friend in L.A. Eddie's on the Southwest side. Eddie, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, thank you, John. We need to have better security on this. We need to have capacity limits as far as how many people can go to these concerts. And also, how are they letting people in? You had this guy with a needle poking people.
Oh, yeah.
We still are. That's kind of like under the radar. I hope they get this guy. I mean, and this can happen again. I mean, you go to any of these big crowds, there's some wacko in the crowd. You could have a needle or a gun. So they need to frisk these people better.
Yeah, you know, large events, you know, speaking from experience, crowd control has always been a problem. A buddy of mine just texted me, what about the Stones and Altamont? You know, Mick Jagger, I think, got the Hells Angels to, this is back in the 60s, early 70s, there were deaths there, stabbings, I think, Hells Angels involved. But I was at Alpine Valley years ago, and it was The Who. And it was a real rainy, it had been raining for a few days, and we were on the hill, and I was down, I had good seats. I don't remember if there were seats or I was just standing in front of the stage, but literally the crowd behind me started sliding down the hill. And I was there with a girlfriend at that time, and I said, as much as I want to stay for this thing, I think it's going to get out of hand, and right now we should just take off. We had seen, you know, probably two-thirds of the, we'd seen the opening act, and then we'd seen The Who, and I thought, you know, it's just too wet and too sloppy out here, and this whole hill is going to cut loose and come down on us. So nothing wound up happening, but still, you know, I've been in the middle of some big crowds in the past where I thought, okay, this is just enough. It could break bad really quickly. So I concur. I'm too old to do that nowadays. I'd like to have a seat, a table, and a waitress, too. Thank you, Eddie. Let's quickly go to Jim. He's in Bridgman, Michigan. Jim, welcome to Double DS, sir. Go ahead.
How you doing, John?
Just wanted to call. I'm doing well. Thank you.
You know, I guess it was kind of obligatory. I really wasn't curious how you were doing, but it kind of just comes out naturally, you know.
I know, and I shouldn't answer because it throws off the rhythm of the call, but I feel if I don't answer, I'm being arrogant and rude.
Well, of course you wouldn't be arrogant and rude. And a guy like me, I'm like Fred Astaire with my balance, so don't worry. You won't throw me off at all, John. But I feel like I'm really excited to see the experiment of all Democrats, you know, running the federal government. I hope that it's like Chicago. I hope we reach the point where we are now, this paradise we live in, much like in San Francisco and in New York, where it's an all-Democrat-run system, and things are wonderful. So I really hope that we reach that same level of nirvana, if you will, here, you know, across the country.
I'm catching the sarcasm in your voice, but you realize we don't want Seattle, we don't want Portland, we don't want San Francisco. There can be no self-government without self-control, both on the left and the right.
I agree, and honestly, I think there really, if we really look at it, I don't really think there is much of a left or a right. I think it's a lot of people that are pampered and don't really understand real working Americans, and then there's the rest of us real working Americans. So politicians, real working Americans. I think Republican Democrats more of a farce that they've got us to believe, and I think as soon as we realize that this is kind of all a game that we're all kind of playing, and we can get on with really moving forward and being the America that we could be, yeah. Make this country great again, if you would.
Yeah, it also, America works best when it's a melting pot. We buy into the same sort of core values. We may not agree on the politics, but hey, this is it. We have the peaceful transfer. That's just one of the, you know, one of the stipulations of it, essentially mutually shared core values. And we're a melting pot. We can't be a tossed salad where everybody they decide they have their own little fiefdom and they have their own little corner of the economy and their own little corner of geography and they can do whatever the hell they want. And the other side is an existential threat and they need to be eliminated one way or the other. That's the problem. And I hope we haven't reached that point. Now, we have previously in this country a couple of different times, as a matter of fact. Maybe it just comes around every 80 to 100 years. Jim, enjoy your time in Bridgman, Michigan. If you're a golfer, there's an excellent course there, a couple of them actually. All right, coming up next in the six, when we return after the news, Jeff Arnold will be here. He's an award-winning journalist and national roving editor for Patch, and he also keeps his eye on the White Sox. The White Sox have decided to keep Tony La Russa. I'm a White Sox fan. I'm a La Russa fan. I'm encouraged but skeptical about this, so we'll take that up with Jeff Arnold. Also, Selena Zito, who's a terrific journalist who gets off the coast and into the hinterlands of America. She has analysis regarding Virginia that I want you to hear. And the voters, once again, vote against our culture curators. That's her latest column. You know, she hit some straight up the middle. And Selena Zito will be here just after the 6:30 news.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts, on 890 WLS.
Reading for my next guest's piece, which I always read him at Politico.com. When I see a byline, I read it. This is a great paragraph. It's buried in the piece. It's about 20 paragraphs deep. And this is in regards to last Tuesday's shellacking of the Democrats in the election. The difficulty conducting a postmortem after an election like last week's is that the losses were so widespread that it's hard to pin defeat on any one thing. Democrats lost the culture wars, but they also got pinned down on the economy. They were drubbed in rural areas and with non-college educated whites, but they also lost independents in the suburbs. And two issues that worked so well for Democrats last year, the coronavirus and Donald Trump, no longer resonated as much with voters. Now let's welcome David Siders, national political correspondent for Politico.com, back to the Big 89. David, welcome. Any chance that the Democrats can change their message between now and next November?
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I mean, I think so. There's a chance, but I think it's a long shot. Messages are one thing, but the overall mood and tenor of the electorate is a tough ship to turn in less than a year.
Well, the electorate might not change its mind collectively, but certainly the Democrat Party could change their messaging, I would think. You gotta go tell the progressives to pound sand, I would think.
I mean, maybe, but this is part of the problem, right? Moderates might say that, but on the other hand, progressives would say, look at all these policies we're talking about. They all poll really, really well. So how do you, you know, a progressive might say maybe we have a bigger embrace of economic populism or something in a way that talking about roads and bridges might not accomplish. The point is that there's a conflict there. That I think that's what's not going to be resolved. And meanwhile, you're going to have Republicans on one page talking about critical race theory. You name the cultural issue of the day, and I think that's where they really have an advantage.
But even if progressives say America wants, cradle-to-grave health care or a lowering of the age for Medicare, even if they present that because their constituents, that's the number one priority for them, or, police reform or what have you, they have to look at the Electoral College and the way that the playing field is set and realize they can't get that through the Senate. Not now, anyway. Maybe never. So at that point, it's a moot point. Why do they keep fighting the same battles?
Well, that's an interesting point. I think that there's some just a real good point there, because, and I say that because I think one of the bigger problems in what's been going on in Congress is just the lack of doing something. And the fact that this bill was passed on Friday is a huge victory for Democrats, not because of anything it contains, but because for once we're not talking about Democrats fighting. It's a conversation about Democrats getting something done. So that's interesting. I mean, maybe tactically a progressive should say, let's just pass a bill that Manchin wants to. But then you have a bunch of people in the party who would say, well, why are we here passing bills if that's all that we get?
You know, the very definition of the job, especially for House members now, it used to be basically to come and serve your constituents and, compromise. Maybe that's hopeful thinking on my point, because we've had very raucous debates all the way through American history. But now it seems like a lot of these, and I'm talking about hardcore blue and hardcore right both, all they want to do is get noticed and have a fundraising clip played on cable news and social media, so they can fill their coffers so they can go back and defend themselves in a primary and automatically win a foregone general election because there's so much gerrymandering. I mean, the whole definition of the job seems to have changed and become corrupted.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, it's amazing to me that these Republicans, I would have expected Republicans who voted to impeach the former president, Republicans who didn't maybe buy into the big lie. I could expect Republicans to give those members of their party a hard time. But the recriminations that have come in for the Republicans who crossed over and voted for infrastructure are just amazing to me. I mean, this was once the party that was all about roads and bridges. And now, as you say, it's really less about, it's more about getting a video clip for fundraising. I think you're exactly right.
David Siders, you wonder if those very Republicans who voted against this infrastructure plan, because it plays well on cable news, Fox in particular, and for their fundraising, when it comes to the ribbon cutting for the new highway or the new bridge or whatever in the back in their district, I wonder if they'll just point out, honestly, by the way, as you know, I voted against this, but aren't we all glad today that it's opening?
Yeah, I wonder. there's an interesting disconnect that way, right? And there was on the stimulus bill earlier this year, too. But, I mean, that's another part of the problem, too. We're talking about the infrastructure bill right now. I think the odds that any of this matters in the election next year are very, very slim. You know, it was, what was it, 5-6 months ago that there was a massive spending bill passed by Democrats and a lot of talk about how this was a big legislative achievement for the president and for the party. And none of that showed up in any measurable way in the results in Virginia or New Jersey last week. And there's a longer period of time between now and next November. So that's another reason I think I'm skeptical that this plays to their advantage in the long term.
David Siders is here from Politico.com. How worrisome is it to Democrats nationally when they look at Virginia and they realize that suburban women in Virginia voted for Biden last November? They voted for Glenn Youngkin last week.
I think it's a real big concern. I mean, you hear some people who are preparing to, say, take on a Republican incumbent somewhere saying, you know, maybe some Republicans will be easier to define than Glenn Youngkin was because he wasn't an incumbent, didn't have a record to run against. But the lesson from Virginia, especially with those suburban women, but geez, it's everywhere. It was out in the rural areas he did better. That with independents, the messaging from Democrats on Trump just didn't work. And so you take a party that really came to power last year with, you know, Biden getting to the White House and the majorities in Congress really came to power because of two things. It was Donald Trump, and it was the promise of gaining control of COVID. Both of those two issues really fell off in Virginia and New Jersey, just were not top of mind for voters. And that, I think, is the real concern for Democrats, is there's not the messaging that got them where they are is not working anymore. So they need to find something else.
There was tremendous fatigue, obviously, with COVID, the restrictions, the nonstop debate on masks and vaccine mandates that continues. But Trump as well, you know, the Trump burnout factor for all of America was extraordinarily high. And I think that, yeah, you're right. People just like, oh, turn the page, just make it go away, make it go away. What are you going to do for me lately? You know, what are you doing for me tomorrow? What are you doing now?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the season of dysfunction, at least as it was appeared to viewers of the goings on in Washington, I think that hurt Democrats significantly.
Yeah. How is it? You think I've said before that there's no civil war in the Republican Party. That's over. I mean, that's over long ago. The Republican Party is a Trumpian party now. But on the Democrat side of the world, James Carville, who's a Hall of Famer for Democrats as a strategist, Clintonite, you know, comes out of that wing of the party, obviously, and he's a pragmatist, kind of a real politique sort of guy. He said the woke culture is what cost the Democrats a week ago, in a great little segment on Judy Woodruff's show. And AOC and the rest of the progressive wing of the Democrat Party fired back and want to, you know, run him out of town now and draw and quarter him. What does that tell you about the intra-party fight going on?
Well, the fight's going on, and it will continue to. Just today, our revolution leaders, the Bernie Sanders Aligned Group, are going after the centrist Democrat mayor of Buffalo, New York, who you know, prevailed in a write-in campaign against the Democratic Socialist who'd beaten him in the primary. Says that they're going to try to get him stripped of his DNC membership. That's probably not going to happen, but it points to this ongoing conflict among Democrats. I don't think that it will be all tidied up because of the infrastructure vote on Friday. I think we'll quickly be reminded of it as soon as things move on the social spending bill to the Senate. And we're once again talking about Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema.
Yeah. Dave, thanks so much for your time. I enjoy reading you at Politico.com. Have a great evening.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
Okay. That is David Siders. Since I referenced Carville, he was asked this last week, Judy Woodruff over on Channel 11. What happened?
But what's wrong with this stupid wokeness? All right, don't just look at Virginia and New Jersey. Look at Long Island. Look at Buffalo. Look at Minneapolis. Even look at Seattle, Washington. I mean, this defund the police lunacy, just take Abraham Lincoln's name off of schools. I mean, that people see that.
People see that. Where should these Democrats go?
Some of these people need to go to a woke detox center or something. I mean, they're expressing a language that people just don't use. And there's a backlash and a frustration at that. And I'd be right, suburbanites in northern Virginia, suburbanites in northern New Jersey, you know, pulled away a little bit.
But wait a minute. What about the learned class in the chattering class in the faculty lounge?
And these faculty lounge people that sit around mulling about, I don't know what, they're not working. Look what happened in Buffalo. Seattle. I think the Republicans may win a city attorney's race in Seattle, the autonomous zone. Who could even think of something that stupid? And they're suppressing our vote. And I got news for you. You're hurting the party. You're hurting the very people that you want to help.
Snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
A year ago, the Chicago White Sox fans were skeptical about hiring a 76-year-old, albeit Hall of Fame manager, to take a young, talent-laden team into the future. I'm reading from our next guest piece, which I found at Patch.com. Jeff Arnold is an award-winning journalist. He covers a variety of topics, but the White Sox, along with a number of other topics, and he joins us again here on the Big 89. So, yes, I think it's safe to say that White Sox fans were skeptical last year. Is it safe to say that they may still be skeptical about Tony La Russa signing on for at least another year?
You know, I would say that's a mixed bag, depending on who you ask. I think probably at age 76, now 77, Tony La Russa probably maybe surprised a lot of people the way he won over his players, given the way that things looked at the beginning. But I think that, when you come in and you win a division, in your first year back with a team, after so many years away and you can do it the way that he did it with them playing through injuries and like I said, winning over the clubhouse, you know, he had to win over somebody.
But Rick Renteria was fired after the Sox made the playoffs and lost to the A's after four games. What's the difference between Rick Renteria's record and Tony La Russa's record?
Well, I would say two things. I would say Tony La Russa's won three World Series. And granted, you know, the last one was in 2011. But you've got to also remember, this was Jerry Reinsdorf's pick. You know, I mean, they go way back from, you know, Tony's first stint with the team. And I think, you know, Jerry Reinsdorf's opinion still matters on the South Side. And I think, when you're the owner of the team and you say, this is my guy, because, you know, in all honesty, it really seemed early on that, you know, general manager Rick Hahn wasn't even crazy about, you know, the pick when, you know, somebody like A.J. Hinch, the former Astros manager who won the World Series, was available. And so I think... you know, I think the fact that, you know, Jerry said, this is my guy, and look, he's won, I think that's the big difference, is that, you know, he's got the owner's blessing.
I've noticed that the guys that sign the paychecks generally get their way. We're talking here with Jeff Arnold. He's an award-winning journalist, national roving editor for thepatch.com. You mentioned the players, and I saw in your piece at Patch that the players were asked whether they wanted Tony La Russa to come back. That seems a little out of character for a Reinsdorf team, doesn't it?
You know, maybe it does, but I think, you know, right after the season, Tony La Russa said, listen, I want to come back, but I don't want to be here unless the players that I manage want me here. And, you know, at the end of the day, that has to matter, because I think, you know, like in anybody's profession, nobody wants to be told this is who you're going to work for. I mean, some places you don't have the option of, you know, choosing your boss. But I think, you know, when your boss says, listen, I'm only going to be happy unless the people that I manage are happy having me here and doing my job, you know, that's got to account for something. And I think that goes back to the way that La Russa won this team over. Namely, you know, guys like Tim Anderson and Jose Abreu, and, you know, obviously with their star power and their voice in the clubhouse, that matters. And so, you know, I think all the stars aligned, you know, for him to come back.
What players had a vote in this?
I would say that, you know, you know, I would say that they had to. I don't think, you know, Tony La Russa was ever going to say, listen, if two or three key guys want me back, then I'll come back. I think it had to be a majority decision. And I think when you look at the way that, like I said, with the injuries the Sox had this year, and, you know, granted, you know, things did not work out the way anybody hoped. You know, I think everybody wanted, you know, to get beyond where Renteria got him last year, you know, the first round of the playoffs, especially with, you know, the momentum they played with throughout the year. But I think that if, you know, things went as well as they did this year and, you know, you've got guys like Anderson and Abreu or who are kind of saying, listen, you know, this is our guy and this is the right guy for the job. You know, obviously the younger players are going to listen to that and say, we, you know, maybe they're onto something here.
Well, he'll have at least one more year to prove that to us. Jeff Arnold, thank you very much for your time. Tell Mark Conkle we said hi, and we'll read more at patch.com.
All right. Thanks so much, John.
Well, I would never apologize for our clubhouse. I thought they had to. They needed it because they didn't try. We accomplished, you know, the first goal, but, I mean, we're disappointed to get one win and not two more. So, you know, bittersweet.
I would say bittersweet, sure. Tony, even when asked uncomfortable questions from the press, he's much calmer now than he was, oh, say, back in the 80s.
I don't want to talk about that bull, all right?
Okay, don't yell at me.
I'll yell if I want to.
Get out and yell back, too.
Get the
out of
here. Interview's over.
Get on full and be a man.
Be a man! The man's on the out when he got
the out of here.
You got about that much sense in the budget. Kid was just born.
I wonder who that journalist was back in those days covering the White Sox.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Before we get to our next guest, who's a terrific writer, catcher in the Washington Examiner, New York Post, RealClearPolitics.com, because she mentions Rahm Emanuel as being essentially a guy who knew how to play to the middle back in those days when he was part of the Clinton White House, what have you. He understood that you have to appeal to the people in flyover country. And since I love just listening to James Carville, when asked by Judy Woodruff what went wrong last Tuesday, he said,
"What went wrong was just stupid wokeness. All right, don't just look at Virginia and New Jersey. Look at Long Island. Look at Buffalo. Look at Minneapolis. Even look at Seattle, Washington. I mean, just defund the police lunacy. Just take Abraham Lincoln's name off of schools. I mean, that people see that."
And he didn't mention this phrase, but our guest will. Cultural curators, in other words, the people that hang out in the faculty lounge.
And these faculty lounge people that sit around mulling about, I don't know what, they're not working. Look what happened in Buffalo. Seattle. I think the Republicans may win a city attorney's race in Seattle. The autonomous zones. Who could even think of something that stupid? And they're suppressing our vote and... I got news for you. You're hurting the party. You're hurting the very people that you want, that you want to help.
Who could even think of something that stupid? Reading from Selena's piece, Washington Examiner. In 2006, Republicans were widely out of step with their constituents. Democrats such as Rahm Emanuel wisely understood that and recruited Democratic candidates who could win in conservative districts. They created the We Share Your Values messaging campaign appealing to the independent, the Republican, and the Democratic voter. They won big in that year's midterm elections. Now let's welcome Selena Zito back for her regular visit to the Big 89. Selena, good evening. How are you?
Good evening. Thanks so much for having me on.
In what part of flyover country do we find you tonight?
Oh, tonight I'm actually in western Pennsylvania. I'm finally home.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Pennsylvania because you bring up the governor there and how he had his wife drop off his mail-in battle and that ballot, and that turned out to be illegal. They had a real scare in Pennsylvania as well. What are the Democrats missing here that they probably will not be able to correct before the midterms a year from now?
Well, you know, I think their larger problem, their largest problem is that they're wildly out of step with the people that formed the coalition that helped place Biden in office. You know, there was this promise to return to normal, that things were going to be calm, that Biden was going to be moderate. And beginning on day one, with canceling the Keystone Pipeline and closing the federal land, the energy production on federal land in South Dakota, New Mexico, Louisiana, Oklahoma, you all of a sudden create this overreach that has not sort of stopped, but instead continued. You know, Biden was given a very slim win in a year ago. And so the House Democrats are barely have a majority. They lost 13 seats that they were supposed to win, plus an additional 10 seats that they were supposed to win. So they actually lost 20 seats that they were projected to win. So they have, I think, 4 or 5 majority. And the Senate, there's not a majority there. The only thing that gives them the upper hand is the vice president. So there's no mandate there. And yet they have behaved as though they could spend like drunken sailors.
Do they?
And the voters were, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, do you think they have the same feeling now, knowing that Biden is definitely a one-term president, just because of his age, I would think. I'm not saying that disrespectfully, but he is 78 years old. And secondly, that Obama, after he was reelected, he was shellacked, of course, in the midterms, and he spent, as you wrote, his second term going all in with executive action because Democrats' mindset is they're always going to lose the next election. So you might as well get while you can get what you can get at that time because the voters aren't going to, even if they elected you the first time around, they're not going to let you stick it out because they're dissatisfied. Do you get the feeling that's what's going on now in Biden's first term, that they already know the gig is up?
No, they don't think they're going to lose. Absolutely. I talked to them. They don't think they're going to lose, and they don't think they did anything wrong. They think this is very specific about Virginia. They believe that everyone that voted for Youngkin is a racist, and they believe that this is all about Donald Trump. However, they would be wrong. And people could check out the reporting that all the reporting that I've done at SelenaZito.com. But, you know, this race was very localized. It was about community. It was about family. It was about your legacy, your children and your grandchildren. And it had nothing to do with Donald Trump. It had absolutely nothing to do with the voters being racist. This always sort of like blows my mind because the very people that voted for you the last in 2020 in Virginia, all of a sudden within a year have become racist. How does that happen? It doesn't. It's just that they're unable to accept the fact that they lost and they show no remorse or redemption or reversal of their behavior, and this is going to be an unbelievable shellacking next year that might exceed 60 seats.
That's like, you know, that is political malpractice. You know, a football coach would be fired if they don't make halftime adjustments when they're down.
Well, here's you know, when I say cultural curators, sometimes people don't understand what I mean, which is why everyone should read my book, The Great Revolt. But cultural curators are the people that control what happens in culture. So what does that mean? That means major news organizations. That means corporations. That means national and major league football and baseball teams and the basketball and the NBA. It also means Hollywood, and it also means the national media. I can't remember if I mentioned that. And institutions and academia, right? These are the people that have the loudest voice, the most power in culture. And they all collectively live in this sort of same super zip codes of either New York, Washington, D.C., or Silicon Valley. They're the ones that control all the messaging on all the movies and everything that we hear. But they are so completely disconnected from the people that live outside of those super zip codes. That is sort of the problem for the Democrats because that is who their coalition is. That is not a winning coalition. You are turning rural, not just rural voters off, but you're also turning off working class voters. You're turning off Hispanic voters. You are turning off suburban voters. And because you are not in touch with what happens in their lives and they are exhausted by, maybe you don't call them a racist, but you call someone in their family a racist. I mean, that's literally exhausting and unsustainable. And that sort of is the problem that the Democrats have right now. I'm not saying the Republicans are not without problems, but the Democrats have the bigger problem.
Boy, when you listen to a guy like Carville, you know, I played those two cuts from James Carville, or Rahm Emanuel, not necessarily likable guys, but they seem to be pragmatists, and they understood that you can't marginalize all of flyover America. Is there anybody at all in the Democrat Party that can bring that message to people in Western Pennsylvania?
Well, they have vilified the two people in the Democratic Party that can do it. That's Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. They are now the out members of the party, and they would neither of them would ever run for president because you could never get through a primary. Because who shows up in a primary? The leftist wing, if you're a Democrat, or the rightist wing in your, if you're a Republican. So they've given no room for the pragmatist to rise up to be a leader in the party.
Remember that, in fact, was he from Ohio or Pennsylvania? His last name was Ryan. He's a congressman.
Tim Ryan.
Tim Ryan?
Tim Ryan, who, by the way, I have known for over 30 years, who was, for all intents and purposes, he was a pro-life, pro-gun Democrat.
Yeah, I thought he was in the presidential race for a cup of coffee and couldn't get a single vote in Iowa or a single vote in New Hampshire.
And he has now gone so far left, and he's now running for the Senate seat in Ohio. You're not going to win Ohio going left. That's the wrong turn. Ohio is now plus 8% more Republican than the country as a whole.
Gosh, I just don't know who's in charge over there. I mean, they're just going to snatch.
But they don't know people that are different than them, and they surround themselves by people who think just like they do, and therefore no one is there in the room that says, "Oh, you guys feel like this is like maybe a bad idea." The one person that is telling him that is Joe Manchin, and they're just trying to sort of destroy his life.
Yeah. Who do you like in the game tonight? I'm guessing the Steelers.
Okay, so I haven't watched football since 2016 because and I will tell you why. Everything, my job is politics. I work for full time for three different news organizations. The last thing I want is to be entertained and to be scolded at watching football. So I gave it up. Yeah. I watch Hallmark Channel.
I watch so little of pro sports now, just because there's so many commercials, and I'm just so sick of the showboating. It just irritates me to no end. So I'll watch tonight because I always like watching a game in Pittsburgh. You know, the Steelers haven't lost a Monday night home game. I don't know in how many years, but it's been forever. They do pretty well there on Monday nights in Pittsburgh. So we'll see.
And, you know, and I love the Steelers. You know, the Steelers in the 1970s, when the entire sort of city was falling apart, when the steel industry collapsed, it was the one cultural touchstone that made us feel good about ourselves.
Yeah, such great teams. Did you hear what Terry Bradshaw said about Aaron Rodgers today?
And this is why I don't listen, because he probably said something stupid.
Well, he was just calling out Rodgers for the ivermectin Joe Rogan thing. So, but good old Terry, you know, he's a man of strong opinion too. Selena, I always enjoy talking to you. Can we talk a couple weeks from now?
Absolutely. And if I can, you know, make a shameless plug, people can sign up for my emails. They're free. They're fine. They're not battening. And at selenazito.com, and you can catch all my reporting. You would have known what was going to happen in Virginia and New Jersey if you'd been reading me.
Well, I do read you, so I knew that. I gave you proper attribution, too. I said, Selena thinks this is going totally the other way. Terry McAuliffe, I said, was up by 8. Now he's down by at least 4 or 5 ticks. Youngkin will win going away, according to Selena Zito. I said that before the election. All right, Selena, thank you.
Thanks so much. Have a good evening.
See you. Bye.